I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Education, healthcare, and employment, they're all necessary to thrive in the United States. But is it the government's obligation to provide them? Today, the ethics professors weigh in on that argument. We'll get their views on the role of the individual when it comes to meeting the needs of their community. If your neighbor's bowl is empty, do you move to fill it? And what about the technology that allows filmmakers to bring deceased actors to life? Since the stars are unable to give consent, concerns are popping up about fair use. Finally, we wrap things up with the weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The Affordable Care Act is very much back in the news these days as President Trump and Republicans in Congress take aim at major modifications to a program that now covers millions. A national health care program remains intensely controversial in this country. So did Bernie Sanders' proposal last fall for tuition-free higher education. All this raises a big, meaty ethical question. What is the moral obligation of a government to its citizens? Governments at different levels now provide retirement security and prescription drugs and K through 12 education and health care. Should good-paying jobs be on that list, too? How about a house with and a two-car garage? Or providing good food to eat because everybody needs good food to reach their true potential? We'll talk about this with our ethics professors today, and we'll also kick around this idea that technology now allows filmmakers to digitally resurrect dead actors for movie roles. We saw in the latest Star Wars movie, but can you use a person's likeness when they can't consent to it? Our ethics professors, once again, are Wayne Vaught. He's the dean of the UMKC College of Arts and Sciences. He's also a professor of philosophy, medicine, and bioethics. He's one of my bosses over at the university. Wayne, welcome back.
Great to be here, Steve.
Clancy Martin is also here. He's a professor in the Department of Philosophy at UMKC and a professor of business ethics at the Block School of Management. Clancy, good morning.
Thanks for having us, Steve.
And for our listeners, the question on the table is, how far should government go in providing American citizens with the basics, like education and health care? Should a job be on that list, or a home even? Give us a call, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Well, Wayne, our government runs a series of programs aimed at providing citizens with the opportunity to succeed and potentially enjoy a happy, healthy life. Education, healthcare, prescription drugs, they're all on the table, a sprawling interstate highway system. My question is, how should we determine what needs to be on that list, or maybe what else needs to be on that list?
Well, there are probably a number of different ways that we can look at it, different questions that would come up, and I don't think it's one that comes down to what are we looking at when we're asking questions about, say, healthcare. Are we doing it because it's providing an individual good for one person who might need it? Or can it be looked at from a more collective view? Is the access to universal health care something that, while it might actually have some beneficial goods, would have beneficial goods to individuals, can it be looked at more globally? More as, we don't privatize, say, something like the military. And it's been my positioning sort of contention on this for a long time is that healthcare really is sort of fundamentally not that much different than the military or a national security issue. It's something about preserving the basic core of who we are as a nation. I mean, without people, we are nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you have something like healthcare, which is providing access to equity in terms of giving individuals access to health care, you are in fact not just sort of treating an individual, but you're treating a nation. You're ensuring that there is a certain quality, certain standard,
right,
that increases the overall health of the nation. And I think one of our greatest security risks certainly an economic risk going forward, is the health of this country mm-hmm. and the health of the people who make up the country. And so if you have a sick populace, if you have high diabetics, if you have all of the health conditions that will have economic impact on the country, but also security risks, because these other it gives the other countries in the world that might have, that do have universal access to health care, opportunities to excel and exceed in us in economic factors, but also to take advantage of an unhealthy population in the United States. So there's one way I think that you could look at the issue of health care and access to it, not as there's this one individual that we should reach out to and help, but we're really kind of looking at it more as access to a service that is absolutely critical to the health of a nation. And a second way in which you could look at it, and it's not just looking at the individual, but looking at the economic impact of it, we claim to be a nation that encourages entrepreneurship, that encourages this free market in order to thrive. And we know that, in fact, in a system prior to the Affordable Care Act, not having access to health care was an impediment to people mm-hmm. opening mm-hmm. up small businesses. People had to have one of their spouses perhaps working in a job that had health care benefits so that they could go out and do their own thing. And so this now is actually an impediment to an economic system that is actually contrary to, I think, a lot of the popular views about the way the nation economically should be driven.
Well, you know, Clancy, so, this notion that Wayne just described as healthcare being essential in some ways, couldn't you also make the same argument that access to higher education, as Bernie Sanders talked about, falls into that category? Couldn't you argue that a well-paying job falls into that category? Couldn't you argue, as Sister Berta does down at Operation Breakthrough, that's Missouri's largest daycare center, she says to me, you take care of poverty in this country, you solve the crime problem overnight. So why not go there as well and rid this country of the scourge of crime, if you buy her theory?
Well, I do think that all of those things should, in fact, be on our lists, and our certainly Wayne's argument could be applied to any of them. Absolutely, could be applied to the question of poverty, could be applied to the question of employment, and absolutely could and should be applied to the question of education. Now, that said, we run into one of the problems with Wayne's argument, which is that the money has to come from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, it is the case that when we are addressing public concerns mm-hmm. using public funds, there's only one place for the money to come from, which is from the tax base. But
other countries around the world deal with this and deal with it very adroitly, arguably. Their tax rates are higher. So is there moral obligation to go there?
Well, I think one argument that Wayne did not bring up in favor of healthcare in particular, being a right that we guarantee our citizens, is the economic argument. Because as a matter of fact, as we all know or ought to know if we don't, healthcare is, considering industrialized nations around the world, the United States has the most expensive healthcare system, and yet we have among the worst healthcare comparing industrialized nations and one of the lowest
outcomes. Healthcare outcomes are poor in the United States.
Obamacare did not deal, generally speaking, with the cost of the system. It dealt with other issues.
Yeah. Well, and it's a work in progress.
Right.
It's a step in the direction of something resembling universal healthcare. It is mm-hmm. not itself, as again we know, universal healthcare. But this to say that there is an argument, an economic argument, in favor of something approximating universal health care, because other countries who have this, both their health care systems cost less than ours do mm-hmm. and they provide better outcomes than ours does. So that's an economic argument in favor of it. Now, that said, we have this tradition of life, liberty, and the pursuit of justice and the pursuit of happiness in this country.
You're taking the words that I was going to bring up. That's from our Declaration of Independence.
Exactly.
I was going to go there later on.
And we could argue that health care is part of what constitutes life, but we also have to recognize the importance of liberty. And the argument that was perhaps most persuasively made, at least in terms of our politics and our government, by the Harvard professor and philosopher Robert Nozick, is that one thing we should recognize is any time we attempt to equalize any sort of entitlement, someone has to pay for that, and people have to pay because people's means are different, people have to pay different amounts. So wealthier people are going to have to pay more than poorer people. Now, the question is, does that constitute an interference with the liberty of those people who are paying more? Because unless they are doing so voluntarily.
You could argue we could double federal taxes. And again, the argument could be that people would still have liberty. It wouldn't completely wipe out their ability to do many things they want to do, but it would take care of problems like hunger and lack of access to higher education and those kinds of issues.
Well, and I agree with that. I fundamentally think that this would be a major step in the right direction and the end of the day would actually improve the economic well-being of the country as well. But we should recognize the argument on the other side, which is that fundamentally in this country, we do have a basic respect for liberty. Anytime we empower the government to go take money out of your pocket or to distribute your property in some other way, we are absolutely interfering with your liberty, except in those cases where people are volunteering to pay more taxes, which is a very rare thing indeed. I know every year I pay as little taxes as I can do while following the law and the system.
I think we all want to take a look at Clancy's tax return. I've had my suspicions about them.
He won't release them.
Yeah. But, he and a lot of people these days, yeah.
But it is simply the case that we need, because we are, in addition to having a tremendous value on life, we also have this tremendous value on liberty in this country. We better have very, very strong arguments before we increase taxes or when we engage in any kind of property reallocation.
Let me get our listeners involved here. How much farther should our government go in providing the kinds of services that might give people, even help them fulfill their potentials to an even greater extent? 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. So what did the great philosophers back in the day, Aristotle and the like, say about these kinds of questions as they were involved in setting up governments and in the beginning of time when governments were first being set up? What do we know about that?
Well, both the founders in the West of our current political system were really Thomas Hobbes and John Locke. And for both Hobbes and Locke, at the end of the day, when the government is failing to properly, the fundamental recognition is that we join this social contract because it is in our interest to do so. When it is no longer in our interest to join this social contract, according to both Hobbes and Locke in slightly different arguments.
Social contract meaning living in a certain country?
Yeah, living in a particular country with a particular set of rules.
And agreeing to those rules.
Those
yeah.
laws, mm-hmm. those rules, those principles.
Mm-hmm. That's a bit of an arbitrary structure, because we don't actually at birth kind of sign an agreement to be part of a social contract. So they put in, this goes back to Socrates and Plato as well, the basically the idea that you are receiving benefits from a society and therefore you have certain obligations and duties to that society because of the benefit that you receive. And Clancy's basically the point, what he's saying is that if you recognize that at some point in time, it's not just that you're not getting benefits, but you're actually being significantly burdened and harmed by this government, then you have a right to rebel and rebuke the government. Mm-hmm. And that's where we saw the various revolutions from which these authors gave a philosophical voice to, which ultimately had great impact on our founding fathers as well.
Okay. Let's go to some phone calls here. 816-235-2888 is the number. How far should our government go in providing you services? Should higher education be on the line, a good-paying job, a home, all those kinds of things? That's what we're talking about today with our good ethics professors here. Terry from Independence, you're on the show, Terry.
Yes, good morning. I was interested primarily in the healthcare issue. You were talking about the economic problems, taking money from the rich and helping out those that are less fortunate. However, with a single-payer healthcare system such as HR 676, you would actually have a situation where 95% of the population would save money over what they pay in premiums and healthcare costs today. Have you researched HR 676 or looked at Physicians for a National Health Plan website?
He raises this whole notion of the benefits of a single-payer plan, which arguably would be a cheaper plan overall. There's disagreements on that point. But if there is a cheaper alternative, you wonder why the government might not consider it more closely, Clancy.
Sure. It is certainly the case that Wayne is an expert in this issue, and I should let him speak. But it is certainly the case that when we look at, as we said before, when we look at other industrialized nations who have plans that are fundamentally simpler than the plan we presently adopted because right. of the complexity of the states and insurance companies in our nation.
And our politics.
And our politics, absolutely. They have outcomes that cost less, cost individuals less, cost groups less, and provide better health care. And this we should take this as an admonition and an imperative. We should mm-hmm. recognize the fact that our healthcare is only getting more expensive. We seem to be getting only clumsier with it, and our healthcare seems to be deteriorating rather than improving in this country on the whole.
Yeah.
And yet, other nations seem to be able to make this work. I know, speaking on my own from my own experience, growing up in Canada, the culture of healthcare that we had was fundamentally different than the culture of healthcare that I've experienced here in the United States. Well, the most obvious thing to me was the difference between people seeking health, very actively seeking healthcare versus people having a kind of culture of avoidance of physicians and very actively seeking health.
Mm-hmm.
And in Canada, there's, when I was growing up, and I think still today, a very strong emphasis on a healthy lifestyle and a kind of aversion to going to the doctor, despite That's the fact that it is, you know, free, so-called.
Yeah.
In the United States, where I've spent most of my adult life, most of the people I know do not necessarily, although it's changing a little, I think, but do not necessarily encourage themselves and their family and friends to have the healthiest lifestyles. And yet, as soon as they are sick, off to the doctor they go as quickly as possible.
Wayne, weigh in here, Mr. Expert on
whether I'm a complete expert on this particular aspect of it, I'm not sure. But I will agree. I'm not familiar with the bill that the caller has alluded to and haven't looked into that, though I certainly would concur with him that a single-payer systems are the systems that we see in most of the industrialized countries in the world. And I don't think it's an issue of whether it's a single-payer or a privatized system that really is sort of fundamentally the problem. The problem is we don't have a managed healthcare system, a program, because no system, whether it's a single-payer or whether we have private payers that don't make some really difficult and tough decisions about how healthcare is managed, about how access to drugs and how the pharmaceutical industry is managed, about how healthcare resources, whether they be MRIs or whatever we're talking about. And if they're all privatized, you see increased costs. So there have to be opportunities to manage those types of services, and having a healthcare system in which very difficult decisions about, you know, how many MRIs are we going to have in the mm-hmm. Kansas City area? And if we have various people competing for them and individuals want to have the nicest facilities to get their customers and we're all competing for the same number of people, the price is going to go up.
Right.
Because you have more of them, you got to pay for them. If you have healthcare systems where those things are allocated and there are a few, and so you may have longer waits to get access to certain types of things, though we have pretty good waits to get access to things now in our current healthcare system, then you're going to be able to more effectively manage cost. So I think in one of the advantages of a universal system is that it's not just simply a single payer, which is going to alleviate a lot of the costs as well and the administrative costs. But you have a sort of a deliberate system that's trying to manage the actual costs and expenses and the things that we do.
And we don't have that now.
And we don't have anything anywhere near approximating something like that in the United States. So we have people competing for resources and competing in open market. And the other challenge, and why I think the open market system is so difficult, is that it's not like going out and buying a television set. Mm-hmm. These aren't optional things. These are people's lives. And you don't go around and easily shop for, well, let's see, what's this surgeon going to do this procedure for? Well, I know Consumer Reports said this surgeon does it for less money. You don't have that ability to comparison shop. It's all handled by third-party payers in an industry that is all very tightly knit, and it's just nearly impossible in this system to break through those barriers and create a low-cost system.
So. Let's go back to some calls here. Jerry from Kansas City, Missouri. Jerry, you're on Up to Date with our ethics professors. Good morning.
Hi. Thanks for the opportunity.
Sure.
I just wanted to compliment you on being specific about healthcare versus health insurance, because often when the media reports this, and it's kind of frustrating to me, they use those terms interchangeably.
Right.
And a lot of people do think people should get healthcare, but a lot of people object to paying for-profit insurance companies premiums.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been part of the thing that I think has been underreported, and what the real objection to is with what the federal government did with the Obamacare. A lot of people like me really do think people should get health care and should be entitled to it, but I don't like the way that they went about it.
Right.
And the other thing that I was asked by your producers is whether other things we might be entitled to, and I think safety and freedom of movement, freedom of speech, all those things are things I think that the government should be providing.
Okay. Appreciate the phone call, Jerry. Thank you.
Bye.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. The question on the table for our listeners, how far should government go in providing American citizens with the basics like education and health care? Should a job be on that list, maybe a four-bedroom home and a two-car garage and all those kinds of things as well? Our number, 816-235-2888. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we checked in with KCK Mayor Mark Holland on the state of his city and Wyandotte County, and the political pundits reviewed President Trump's address to Congress. You can find those conversations at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse from Rhode Island speaks about corporate influence on the floor of the U.S. Senate. Also, two Kansas City storytellers explain why sci-fi is their favorite genre. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, this hour we're visiting with our ethics professors, Clancy Martin, Wayne Vaught from UMKC, about what a basic government obligations exist out there. Maybe they go beyond health care to other needs like a home or even free college tuition. Our phone number, 816-235-2888. Let's go to Aaron from Liberty. Aaron's been holding a while. Aaron, thanks for hanging on.
Hi.
Hi.
So I really do strongly feel that liberty is extremely important, and I think that privatization is not a bad thing, and that maybe it hasn't been so great in the past sometimes, but I think that it could work better than government insurance of everybody having health care. I personally believe that's true.
Why?
Because I think that first of all, I think it's important to not be reaching into everyone's pockets. And I think that if it is privatized, that more people – let me get this all – sorry. So I think that more people would be willing to give more money to charity and more money to help out if they weren't paying so much taxes. That's the basis of my beliefs on that.
So you could take care of a lot of needs if we just got taxes lowered, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that richer people would be willing to give more if they weren't being stolen from, essentially.
Okay. Let's have our doctors respond to that. What do you think, Wayne?
Well, you're already paying it, and that's the challenge, that it is a hidden cost, but you are paying it. So you pay your health insurance premiums, maybe you go to the doctor and your employer is paying, if you have an employer-based health care, premiums, and they have costs. Well, how much does it cost, and how do they set these rates? And a lot of them are negotiated with the hospitals and the providers that provide that coverage and that care. And a lot of these providers say a hospital realizes that it has to provide so much indigent care and write off so much for people who can't come in and pay. Well, where does it get the money to do that?
Mm-hmm.
It gets it by charging fees to people who come in for other sorts of things. So people will complain, if you read your list, why are they charging me $15 for Tylenol or whatever it is that might be on the bill? I said, this seems ridiculous. Why are they charging me this? They're charging you this because they're offsetting the costs, and the insurances are working to negotiate those costs with the providers so that we can basically offset those costs anyway. So I think it's sort of a misnomer to assume that we're not already picking up a lot of the costs for indigent care, and certainly the governments will provide hospitals that provide indigent coverage, they can often get state subsidies as well. So there is a lot that's already going into providing that mm-hmm. care to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
We pay more in the United States by far than any other country per capita for health care and for health care expenditures. And the reason that we do that is because we are paying for over costs associated with a variety of inefficiencies that exist in our system that would be alleviated. So I guess my question or response to a caller like this, would you rather pay a certain amount in tax dollars, knowing that that's going to go to provide everyone with health care, or would you rather pay more to a private provider, knowing that that's how basically we have to run our healthcare system so that everyone's getting coverage? And me, I would rather do whatever costs less.
Mm-hmm.
And if that means paying taxes and that's going to cost me less than ultimately the cost of paying a private healthcare insurance, that's the option that I would take.
Particularly when the best evidence shows that if we were to pay less with government involvement, government regulation, recognizing that the invisible hand simply does not work as a method of distribution when it comes to this particular mm-hmm. kind of good, nonetheless, paying less, we would get better outcomes. And so it isn't really complicated in terms of the logic of it. The complications come into the politics.
Let's go to Mark from Kansas City, Missouri. Mark, good morning.
To me, it's a no-brainer that things like health care, if it's privatized, if you have private insurance companies, I've never figured out what a private insurance company provides of value for all the money they skim off the top of our health care dollars.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's executives and people making livings working in that industry. I don't know what they provide to me as a consumer of health care. And that cost seems to be just written off as part of the cost of doing business. When I think a public health care system, if we all share our health as a common good, then we should all share the cost, and it should just be part of our life together.
Hmm.
And it should be administered to the government, I believe, as long as the government isn't corrupted by corporate
right.
kind of democracy.
Mark, I appreciate your comments. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go to Kelly from Midtown. Kelly, you're on the air.
Well, it just occurred to me that none of these goods you're talking about are possible without a clean and sustainable environment. And I think that's what the government owes its citizens more than anything else, immediately and into the future, a sustainable, clean environment.
Okay. Kelly, I appreciate that comment, too. Thank you. Well, gentlemen, let's do this. We just have a few minutes left, and I promised our listeners a second topic that I want to dive into just quickly here. And this is this idea of using technology to allow filmmakers to digitally resurrect dead actors for movie roles. You can also see it when promoters recreate performers for concert performances. You're seeing that these days. There are lots of ethical questions here about the use of a person's likeness when they're obviously unable to consent, and for how long a dead person's right to their image might be protected. We just saw this whole issue resurrected or come to life in the latest Star Wars movie. Clancy, what do you make of this idea of using the likenesses of deceased actors in new movies?
It seems to me to be a clear case where, as we see so often in the intersection between technology and ethics, technology moves a lot faster than the law, certainly, and often than ethics can keep up with. So
you got to speed it up, Kelly Johnson.
Exactly.
You got to get to work.
So I think it is abundantly clear. If you put yourself in the position of an actor who could have this happen, one thing is very important to all of us, our kind of perception by the public, perception by our family, perception by our friends.
Who we are.
Who we are, exactly. It seems like a very fundamental good. So unless you have granted your permission, it seems to me, on the face of it, you have the right to, implicitly, without ever having stated it, that your image would not ever be reproduced in your autonomy would not be seized by some technology for entertainment purpose or any other purpose.
But now, then again, you're dead.
Well, it's true, but what does that really mean? You're still alive in the memories, the imaginations, and the thoughts of the people who love you, the people who care about you. Your who you are is still very much a functional reality in otherwise, it wouldn't be exploited in this way.
Mm-hmm.
There'd be no interest in seeing you unless we already had an ongoing image of you. So it seems to me that you-ness, and it doesn't matter at the end of the day in our kind of digital age, whether it is an actor or a politician or any private person,
mm-hmm.
unless we have given our permission for a person to use us in that way, our individual personalities, it shouldn't be done.
But our law is set up differently, though, isn't it, Wayne? Because once a person, a public figure, dies, you can say anything you want about that person. And I believe I have my facts right. You can't be sued for libel having done it.
Libel. Well, I'm not an attorney, so this would be an interesting question. I think that, you know, with individuals' estates, and there certainly could be financial ties to the estate, and if somebody does something to damage the image of someone in that estate, that I suppose that there could be some legal liability and those types of things. But it would be interesting to get an attorney to come in. What I think, you know, it might be interesting to put some examples of where this might be a reasonable practice that people might not want to object to. Let's suppose, you know, when we film movies now, we want to do a film, say, on Abraham Lincoln. We get a character that might look as closely as possible to Abraham Lincoln. We're going to put a lot of makeup on him. We might even create a mask that the person will wear that would create an exact striking image of Abraham Lincoln.
And that's okay. It seems
nobody would. Nobody. Yeah. When we do this costuming, we would do that. So, is there a difference between costuming, if we're going to do a historical film on Abraham Lincoln, and digitally recreating Abraham Lincoln in a way that creates a much more vivid image that might, you know, capture the heart and the senses and the idea of that the filmmaker wants to do to create this new film on Abraham Lincoln? Now, is Abraham Lincoln perhaps in the public domain in a way that a common private citizen might not be, so that people could have different rights or claims to that public image? I suppose, again, this would be an interesting question about copyright law and about imaging and things that an attorney might come in and have some nice input on us for. But at least I think we could come up with the ethical argument, which is you're asking about. And I think that we could say that there are situations where you could have a morally defensible argument for using a person's likeness in a film to create a film that's to do a particular type of thing. And then there could be, I think, unethical ways in which you might use that likeness. But at least I don't think it is immediately, it's not immediately obvious to me that it is always inherently immoral to engage in this practice.
Okay. We have to leave our conversation there. I want to thank our ethics professors one more time, Wayne Vaught from UMKC, Clancy Martin as well. Thank you both for a good conversation. Always appreciate it, guys.
Thanks so much for having us, Steve.
As we told you at the top of the broadcast this morning, the Kansas Supreme Court ruling in the case of Luke Gannon versus State of Kansas was handed down just this morning. KCUR's Sam Zeff, who reports on education, has been reviewing the decision while we've been on air and brings us the news that so many have been waiting for. Sam, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Well, I don't want to dive into areas that you aren't familiar with yet, but is there a dollar amount attached to this ruling? That's one thing people are going to want to know right away.
No, there's not. The Kansas Supreme Court has never in any of its school funding rulings, and this goes back to the 70s, has never come out with a ruling and said most of the time that this is the amount of money you have to put into public education. They recognize, they say in their opinion, this is up to the legislature, this is up to the people who are elected by Kansans to make these decisions.
So what are they saying today then?
Well, clearly today they've said that the school funding system that is in place now is inadequate, thus it is unconstitutional.
Wow.
So they've ruled—
And they're clear, there's no waffling on that
point. This was a unanimous decision.
Wow.
As was the equity decision, if you remember last year, where they said the school funding was inequitable. That was fixed by the legislature in a special session in the summer. This has been a decision that lawmakers and educators have been thinking about for a long time, fretting about for a long time, pacing in the middle of the night for a long time. And Steve, the first thing I think people need to do is get out their calendars, because June 30th is now the most important date for Kansas education and the Kansas legislature. What the Supreme Court said is that if the legislature cannot come up with a constitutionally adequate funding scheme for Kansas schools on June 30th, there will be no constitutionally adequate funding scheme in Kansas. Thus, schools cannot go forward. Essentially,
no school this fall.
Essentially, right. I mean, well, maybe no summer school. Will it? The legislature, the politics of this is the legislature doesn't want it hanging around their neck that they failed to act. Thus, schools will be closing on June 30th.
So on top of the budget deficits they're facing in Topeka right now, big numbers, big difficult numbers that lawmakers from both parties are grappling with. Now they have on top of that this sort of a little bit vague sense of having to invest a lot more money into public schools. That's only going to complicate budgeting that much more.
It's going to be wildly difficult. And they just came off from a week off. I hope they all got a lot of rest and relaxation, because that is over when they come back on Monday. Some estimates have put fixing this at $500 million. Again, the state Supreme Court did not say that. But it's pretty clear that more money is going to have to be put into this in a school funding formula that they find constitutional. So that means that funding formula has to be both adequate and equitable.
Wow.
They have to work together. This is going to be very complicated.
I'm wondering what kind of reaction you're getting this morning now in the wake of this ruling that just came out about 47 minutes ago from lawmakers themselves, Sam, and the plaintiffs in this case.
Yeah, we've from the governor's office, there was a tweet from the governor's spokesman. The governor's office is reviewing the decision. We'll make further statement once we have fully assessed the court's opinion. Soon after that, State Representative Stephanie Clayton from Overland Park tweeted, "The Kansas legislature owes it to the people of Kansas to set aside invective and fulfill our constitutional obligation to fully fund Kansas education." So we're still waiting for a statement from the governor, more detailed statement, also from Attorney General Derek Schmidt, who fought this case in the state Supreme Court
and lost.
Right. And so the politics going forward, it certainly is. You're absolutely right, Steve. An already brutal and complicated budget situation in the state of Kansas got more so half an hour ago.
Because you're asking still a largely conservative legislature, undoubtedly here, now to raise taxes, maybe a series of taxes to meet what's happened here. How about the timing of this ruling, Sam? What does that mean?
You know, I think a lot of people suspected, including myself, that this ruling would have come before the session to give the legislature the maximum amount of time to work on it. Some people think that it has to do now with the governor's veto of the tax bill, which happened about a week ago, that this is the state Supreme Court coming in and saying we have maintained control of this portion of the controversy, and now it's time to get to work.
The court has said you have enough money to cut taxes, you might have enough money to fund schools.
It suggested that,
yes.
Absolutely. They have absolutely suggested that.
Just a final point here, Sam. Is there a likelihood that this legislature could simply walk away on June 30th and say, we are not going to comply with this decision because we think the court has overstepped its authority.
I think that that would have been more likely a year ago, but with 51 new faces in the legislature, a lot of Democrats, moderate Republicans, I don't think that they're going to do that. I also don't think that any lawmaker wants it hung around their neck that they failed to meet this court deadline, thus shutting down schools.
That's KCUR Sam Zeff, who covers education, who's very quickly digested this very complex ruling from the state Supreme Court this morning on education spending in Kansas. Sam, we sure appreciate it.
My pleasure, Steve. Take a shot for the regrets. Double up and it's bound to get bubble wild. Hey, ladies, let your head out. We know ain't nobody scared now. Just do your thing like a spring break. Wake and bake and we at it again. Live it up for the weekend.
Brian McTavish is here to talk about cool stuff to do this weekend, as he does each week. And how are you, buddy?
Only cool stuff to do.
That's good.
Yeah.
As the song just suggested.
I think you might reject anything else.
Who is singing that song?
Well, that's Brantley Gilbert singing, ready?
Yes.
The Weeknd, how appropriate. And Brantley Gilbert, does that...
That could be our theme song, by the way.
Give Brantley's people a call on that.
Okay.
But does that sound like a country music artist's name, Brantley Gilbert?
No, it doesn't.
No, it doesn't. Good answer. But it is. It's country music party time all the time.
Sounds like somebody rich who would be in an Eddie Murphy movie about rich people or something.
It sounds exactly like that.
Yes.
And now we're calling his reputation into question.
Yes.
You just did. I
yes.
didn't do that.
Okay.
I just led you there. Brantley Gilbert, 7:30, Saturday night at the Sprint Center. It's big time arena country. But, you know, frankly, critics are more reminded of guys like John Cougar Mellencamp or Bruce Springsteen. Bands like R.E.M. and Lynyrd Skynyrd were certainly big influences on Brantley. Yet today, country is almost more of an attitude than it is a time signature.
Very astute, Brian.
Well,
very astute.
And cool, right?
Yes.
Let's not forget that. You know, he had a near-death experience at age 19, 12, 13 years ago. He was driving under the influence. He's said to have escaped without a scratch. He turned his life around And that's good for him and everybody else because he's had big hits like Country Must Be Countrywide, Bottoms Up, and Small Town Throwdown. Don't forget One Hell of an Amen. So these titles do convey a country mystique, but I say he's pretty accessible to everybody out there who likes a Saturday night, or in this case, a Saturday night good time.
That's Brantley Gilbert, Saturday night at the Sprint Center.
Yeah.
Let's go!
What is that?
Well, what do you think of that?
What is that?
What do you think of that?
Not much.
Okay. Next. No, we got to talk about Whitechapel.
We're going to do it.
Hey, this is an all-inclusive weekend to-do list, right? And just because it doesn't turn your crank, give it a chance. Give it a chance.
Oh, I gave it a chance.
There was a bleep.
Enough chance.
Okay. It's called deathcore music.
Deathcore music.
Somehow you don't look surprised.
Ugh.
I'm told the kids love it. Seriously. 6 o'clock, Sunday.
It's got a name, deathcore music?
Deathcore is the brand, if you will. What they do is they downtune. They call it downtuning the guitar, so they sound gloomy and sort of energetically pessimistic, right?
I'm getting that.
Well,
it's taking me down.
It might be good. Maybe they
people
let you
pay money to go hear this.
They pay good money, $25 a pop, and it's going to be the youth market. 6 o'clock Sunday, early show at the Riot Room. Let me very quickly read you a sample lyric. This is from the ditty we're listening to called "Our Endless War." America, our wasteland, where death is entertainment. The place where moving forward means you turn the other direction. A place where reality existed, and we still continue to bleed. Are you
my
bleeding?
Goodness.
Maybe your ears are bleeding. Hey, I should mention also on
and
this
we're gonna
bill.
Move on.
Also on this bill, ready? Goat whore and cattle decapitation. Check
cattle
them out.
Decapitation is the name of a group.
That is the name of a group, which was actually an influence claimed by Whitechapel. So it's nice to know that these crazy guys can work together. Check
cattle decapitation.
Yeah, it could happen. Make it happen.
Be sure to see Brian's 6 exotic things to do in Kansas City this weekend. It's at kcur.org. That's the great Betty LaVette, but that's not what we're talking about here.
Well, we could. Would you like to divert to Betty? No,
I
too
do.
Late. Well, you just did.
I've seen her several times.
She's wonderful, but let's play a
She's
game.
She's very different than deathcore music, just for the record.
Well, officially different, but
a little,
you know.
Up the scale a little bit.
I dare say Betty might be just a tad more open-minded than you are regarding deathcore, but you'd have to have her on here to ask.
Yeah, yes, we would.
And you will. Don't forget to ask her about deathcore. Okay. This is a game that you can play. You've never played this game before, I dare say, unless you were in the audience of a show called Audience at last year's KC Fringe Festival. They're bringing it back. It's the KC Fringe Show. It's an experimental play. They call it a verbal symphony. Here's what happens. You walk in. If you're an audience member, you go to the stage. You sit there on stage or stand or wander. At the same time, four pairs of actors are out in the seats, and each pair of actors is simultaneously engaging in an independent conversation. It's like a Robert Altman film with overlapping dialogue. So you're on stage watching the people in the audience. Are you trying to discern what they're saying? Is it connected? Is there a theme? Who's the real audience? Who's the real actor? I'll tell you what, one way to find out, go to shows 7 and 8:30 Friday and Saturday at the H&R Block City Stage at Union Station, and you can explain it to me.
Okay.
Do it.
You know, there's always classic rock and roll in this town every weekend. There's somebody who's back.
We're a meat and potatoes classic rock town.
Alan Parsons.
Alan Parsons
An
Project.
Oldie but goodie.
Oldie but goodie. This was a hit. I Wouldn't Want to Be Like You from the album, was it iRobot, I believe? 40 years ago.
40 years ago.
40 big ones ago. Classic progressive rock could be an oxymoron, but anyway, 8 o'clock Saturday night, Star Pavilion at Ameristar Casino. Very interesting figure in rock album engineering history. Alan Parsons engineered, he was one of the engineers on the Beatles' Abbey Road and Let It Be.
I didn't know that.
And most notably,
did not know that.
Most fantastically engineered Pink Floyd's The Dark Side of the Moon. And then he had his own career in the 70s and 80s twirling the knobs. And it's a good time for the loyal fans on Saturday night at the Ameristar.
And finally today.
Finally.
What do we have here?
Okay, here we go. Be educated, be entertained, be impressed by real deal. I'm talking authentic belly dancers.
Wow.
Doing moves from the Middle East and North Africa and other faraway parts of the world. Organizers call this monthly get-together 1001 Arabian Nights Belly Dance Show. It happens Saturday at 7 o'clock at night at the Uptown Arts Bar. Organizers are serious people. I imagine they don't mean to make a pun when they say it's going to be a well-rounded experience. I'm pretty sure they're not kidding.
And I recommend Cyrus Chestnut, the great Cyrus Chestnut, the pianist at the Folly Theater. Great jazz, tasteful jazz, playing with vibraphonist Warren Wolf.
Jazz that
I'll be there with my son. It'll be fun.
Oh, jazz that tastes good. I'm all in.
Absolutely.
Thanks a lot.
That's Brian McTavish with your weekend to-do list. Thanks, buddy.
Thanks, pal.
Tomorrow on the show, the struggle between corporate influence and American liberty, with Sheldon Whitehouse, the senator from Rhode Island, and my conversation with two stars from the world of sci-fi storytelling. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Claire Tadakoro. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.